Investing Simplified is brought to you by Chuck Price, President and Wealth Manager of Price Financial Group, Wealth Management Incorporated, a registered investment advisor firm. Individual situations will vary, and the information on this show should only be relied upon when coordinated with individual advice. Other parties present on this broadcast are not affiliated with Price Financial Group Wealth Management. Chuck can be contacted by visiting www.pfgwm.com. You can email Chuck a question at askchuck@pfgwm.com, or you can call him right now at 503-417-7626. That's 503-417-7626. Now, here's the host of Investing Simplified, Chuck Price.
We do Investing Simplified.
Well, welcome to Investing Simplified on another wonderful Saturday morning in Portland, Oregon. It's a little bit damp, but it's really not that cold, and it's raining just a little bit, but not that bad. So for a November morning coming up on Thanksgiving, it's really not bad. In the studio this morning, I've got Carl Jepson with the Warren Allen Law Firm.
Good morning, Chuck. How are you?
Great, Carl. How about you?
I am doing rather well.
Well, you know, last week I had the pleasure of going to the Irrational Economic Summit by Harry Dent, and Harry had numerous guest speakers and economists on there, and we're hoping to connect with Harry this morning to have him live on the air. And I will say this to all of our listeners out there, this is a great opportunity for you to call in and ask a question of a world-renowned economist who's going to be on live air right here in Portland, Oregon. And, you know, there is, I always tell my clients this when I meet with them and they talk to me about their money. I say, look, there is no foolish question when it comes to your money. And I really mean that. And I think if you have a question, of course, you're calling in anonymous. We don't know who's on who is on the air, so you can call in and ask him a question. And I would like to welcome to our show Harry S. Dent, Jr., economist, author, senior editor of the free newsletter Survive and Prosper. And you can sign up at www.harrydent.com, or you can sign up on my website at pfgwm.com. So let's give a great Northwest welcome to Harry Dent. Harry, are you on the line?
Yeah.
Harry, I was just talking before you came on the air about your Irrational Economic Summit. I thought from the ones I've attended, that was by far one of the best meetings you've ever had.
Yeah, no, we were very pleased. It was the first time that we invited like our broader newsletter subscribers and had 12 speakers instead of 5 or 6. So yeah, it was great.
Yeah, we've been pushing our clients on our emails and on our website and on our radio station to sign up. And I know a lot of people have called me and told me they've signed up for your Survive and Prosper newsletter and really enjoy it. It's been a great thing for a lot of people. And I know my co-hosts here, who are an estate planning attorney and a CPA, have enjoyed reading it as well. And, you know, Harry, one of the things that kind of amazed me this yesterday on the news, the big thing on the news seemed to be because China is going to allow people to have more than one child.
Yeah, after 50 years.
Yeah, yeah. And I mean, with all the problems we have in this country with being over $17 trillion in debt, we're concerned about how many kids people can have in China.
Well, you know, the funny thing, Chuck, I mean, that's something they should do since they've cut it off for 50 years, and their workforce is already starting to peak and slow. But once you start having kids, it's 20-some years before they enter the workforce and impact the economy positively. In fact, young people only cost the economy. They cost people raising the kids, families. It costs education systems for government, and it costs businesses to incorporate them in the workforce. So, yeah, this may be something that helps China a little bit, but 20 years from now, not in the next 20 years where they're already slowing.
You know, I listening to several of the speakers there at the summit, one of the things that just really concerned me is the overwhelming fact that almost every one of those speakers had the same concerns about this monumental national debt we're running up. It just seems to be like an avalanche.
Well, Well, yeah, I mean, it just doesn't stop. I mean, we're doubling it every 8 years. It was $5 trillion when Bush came in. 8 years later, it was $10 trillion when Obama came in. Now it's $17 trillion. It's easily going to be $20 by the time he exits. And, you know, where does it end? I mean, we're saying that in the next decade, we're going to hit at least $30 trillion because we're just following Japan. We're running deficits, saying it's okay because it's good for the economy. The economy's slow. But, hey, the economy continues to be slow, and it will continue to get slower as demographic trends get worse. So governments are acting like this is a temporary financial crisis. It's a demographic cliff we've gone off here and around the world, not just us. And we came into this with record debt, government, and much more private debt. We're not letting that private debt deleverage much, and the government debt's just going straight up. So where does this end up? Not good. It's that simple. I mean, a 10-year-old could add up this arithmetic. It doesn't take a genius.
Well, you know, it's amazing to me, though, when I hear these guys come on Fox Business or CNBC, these so-called economists, and they kind of give you crap about your demographic theories and about what you're saying about the market conditions, and they
and I'm too bearish. I mean, we've seen three major crashes in a row, and somehow I'm too bearish, you know.
Well, yeah, I mean, I look at the numbers because I'm a numbers guy, and to me, as I look at the economy, really from about 1999, from December 31st, 1999, this recovery or the new economics, if you want to call it that, in America, is not a very pretty sight.
No, it's not. It's just denial. I mean, the reason the speakers we had at our conference were so good is they're objective. They're realists. It's not like nobody has to be a genius for this. Most economists and most politicians are, even Warren Buffett. I mean, these people are in denial. It's like we've had the biggest debt bubble in history. I can't even compare this to past debt bubbles like the one that peaked in 1929 or 1872 or 1835. Because it was so global, and the debt levels are more than double what they were back then, you know, as a percentage of GDP. So with the greatest debt bubble in history, private and public, and the private debt's about three times the public government debt. Most people don't realize that. And we've got the largest generation in history, which caused the greatest boom in history when they were spending from 1983 to 2007. This generation's done. They're done spending. They're going to spend less for the next decade until the next generation comes along, and it's not as large, by the way, so we'll never see a boom like we saw before. But you got demographic and debt trends just pointing down, down, down. And again, governments are acting like, oh, if we can just get over this temporary, nasty little financial crisis, you know, if we can just keep stimulating year after year after year, we'll get back to normal. There is no getting back to normal, and without this massive amount of stimulus, obviously, when we're just growing at 2%, we would be in a recession or a depression, not any type of growth. So anytime an economist gets on CNBC or any station and says, oh, you know, we've reached, you know, launch velocity, or the economy's finally in a stable, sustainable recovery, I'm like, you have to be crazy. I don't care what degree you have. You're a total idiot if you think this economy could survive without $2 trillion a year in fiscal and monetary stimulus. And that's just in the U.S. Every country's doing this. China, Europe, Japan, England, everybody's stimulating at unprecedented levels just to barely. I mean, Europe's at about zero growth. And the U.S. is at 2% growth, and Japan's just finally got to minor growth with stimulus 2.5 times ours. This is crazy. And they're just going to keep doing this until the thing blows. And it's going to blow at some point, and I think it's going to blow in the first half of next year.
You know, when you talked about this at the meeting, too, that, in fact, you were not the only one saying this. Several people there were saying the same thing, that they felt that somewhere in 2014 we're going to have a major correction in the market that's going to be equivalent to what we had in 2008.
Yeah, I mean, we had a real classical economist, Lacey Hunt. He's the only guy I can bring to these meetings because he's the only realist. I mean, he's not using demographic trends and a lot of the kind of leading-edge stuff we are. He's just looking at classical measures of economic growth and stuff. And he's saying, look, growth, despite all this stimulus, is decelerating at every level he can measure it. And we're coming close to the point where we went into past recessions. And again, other economists look at the data and paint all types of rosy forecasts in the future. That's the only reason they rationalize all this debt. They say, but we'll grow at 4 to 5% again. And no, we're not. We'd be lucky to grow at zero for the next decade with the demographic and debt trends at that. But he got up there, just looked objectively, and boom, his presentation was, hey, we're not there yet, but we're close to the next recession. And, you know, other people looking at chart patterns and things, if you just step back, I mean, Janet Yellen the other day said, we're not in a bubble in the stock market. We don't have to worry about that yet. And I'm like looking at this chart showing this bubble in stocks is now much stronger than the one before it that crashed in 2008 and 2009. And each time the stock market goes up, we hit new high. We go to higher highs, and every time it crashes, we go to lower lows. I mean, if this doesn't look like a bubble, I don't know what does. And the ultimate thing that the government's trying to do, just think about this for a moment. They created the greatest bubble really back at the tech bubble in the 90s with super low interest rates and stimulus. Greenspan kept stimulating, and then of course Bernanke came in and kept stimulating even more with the downturn. What the government is doing is they're trying to keep the bubble going at all costs forever. When a bubble bursts, and you go back in history and look at any debt and financial asset bubble, when they burst, you deleverage a lot of debt and financial assets go down. We destroy a lot of wealth and money temporarily, but that's good long term. It lowers the cost of living and creates efficiency, but it is nasty. The 1930s were nasty. So were the 1870s and 1830s and 40s after every bubble has burst. So the government's just saying, we're just never going to let this bubble burst. That's the craziest thing I've ever heard. How do you keep a bubble going forever? The answer is you can't. And I think the trends, I think they've now stretched this so far for the economy and stocks. When you create bubbles by all this stimulus, since it's not going into loans and stuff, it's not going into sustainable growth and capacity, as Lacey Hunt said. Money velocity is dropping, which shows that it's just speculative gains, not real capacity. Things have stretched so far that I think that it's about to burst, and it's not going to be because our economy suddenly slows or the Fed tapers in next March or April. It's just going to be because something goes wrong, like the subprime crisis in 2008, and then the bubble is so stretched that all it takes is a little prick and the whole thing comes down. So it's hard to get the timing down, but I'm looking at the first quarter of next year for a peak in stocks, and stocks do not look like they peaked yet. They look like they got another maybe 5% on the upside. And then we go back into recession somewhere between the second and third quarter, and then it probably is going to steamroll into a major downturn and a major stock crash. So we'll just have to watch for that. But, as bearish as I am, I'm not seeing signs that the stock market is peaking yet, because the stock market's still looking at endless QE, like they're never going to stop, especially with Yellen coming in.
Harry, I heard one time on CNBC when you were talking, and you had mentioned about everybody's afraid of inflation, but you better be careful about deflation. And one of the things to me that's startling about the American economy right now is the average income is down. The average homeowner's biggest asset, which is their home, is down. And we really almost have deflation right now in the economy because wages are down, less people are working, things are costing less, but nobody can buy them.
Yeah, the best way to look at the economy with all this stimulus is that 80% of the people, and surveys show this, I mean, they've had surveys all over the last year, 80% of people say, we never came out of the recession, just for what you're saying. My home price, my house may still be underwater, my wages are going down, especially adjusted for inflation. I'm not seeing the turnaround. But, the 20% of people who are college educated, 3.5% unemployment, wages going up, they've been the most benefited by the Fed goosing financial assets, because that's where the stimulus has gone. It hasn't gone into lending. It hasn't gone into expanding jobs for the average person. It's gone into people who have financial assets. They will say in the same survey, things are better than ever. They're not facing this decline in deflation, but the average person is. And then if you go around the world, India and Brazil and all the emerging countries, and even China to a degree, they're facing inflation from all this global stimulus, and it's hurting their standard of living because the everyday person this counts for. So basically, to keep this bubble going, the Fed continues to reward the top 10 to 20% of people who already did well in the bubble in the first place, and continues to penalize the everyday person, and the people who are most losing are people who are saving for retirement and can't get an inflation-adjusted return, not even at zero, adjusted for inflation, in safe fixed-income investments, which is what somebody in their 50s or 60s should be investing in. And they're having to go into speculative stocks and commodities and stuff, and they're going to get creamed again when we have the next bubble crash. So the Fed's supposed to protect the average person. They're basically helping the wealthiest households and the banks. They're saving the banks while Main Street continues to get crushed and pays for it.
You know, Harry, this is Carl Jepson. I have the privilege of working with some young, very, very bright lawyers, and I know their situations. And while they're doing okay in a sense, they are really frustrated because they realize this from their own experiences now, that the opportunities are just not going to be there for them the way that maybe they were for some of us, the older guys, and that they're going to have some employment, but it's not the same as it was. And many of their colleagues and even my children, they look at the job market. You know, college educated kids come out of college and they look for something to do. And they might find it if they're really lucky, but more often than not, it's not in the field that they studied, and more often than not, it's at a very low wage compared to what they expected, and they're still trying to pay off, you know, student loans and all that stuff. And they're kind of, not only are they worried, but they're a little bit on the angry side, and I don't blame them. But unfortunately, like you said, there's probably not enough of them to overbalance the people who are getting rich on it right now.
Well, you know, you're right, Carl. That's another dimension. When I talk about these baby boomers, the top 20% with low unemployment and high gains, that's the older ones already in the workforce. You're right. The younger people, even the highly educated coming in, do not have as good a job opportunities. Baby boomers are not leaving the workforce like they should when they return retirement age. And every generation around the world, every country, the older people who have more political power are basically screwing the younger people. In Japan, the young people won't even have sex because they can't even afford to have a kid or get married or even date a woman or anything, because they're getting part-time employment, no lifetime benefits, none of the entitlements their parents got. So this is happening around the world. I mean, you look at the unemployment in Europe, in Southern Europe, Spain and stuff. It's 57%. So the young people are inheriting all this debt, and the young people are getting less good jobs and benefits. So the people, the older people, are basically screwing the young generation. That's not very good for the economy in the future, because these young people are the future. Old people are just going to retire, just going to slow down, as we all do. And I'm an old person now, you know. And if the young people aren't employed and they're not motivated, if they don't see a good future, they're not going to buy houses. They're not even moving out of their parents' house, you know. A lot of kids are staying with their parents until they're 30 or something now. So that's not a good sign.
Well, listen, if you want to call and ask Harry Dent a question, you can call us at 503-417-7626. That's 503-417-7626. This is your opportunity, and there's no foolish question when it comes to your money. And, and that's what we're really talking about is the average person's money. And the average person's money is not going as far as it used to go because there's less of it.
Well, Harry, I'd like to ask you a couple of questions. I kind of blindsided your colleague before on this, but I asked him if he could be king for a day here in the United States, what three things would he do immediately to, you know, that were reasonable things to do to turn the economy around? And so I'm going to ask you the same thing, and that'll, you know, you can say no if you, but I just thought I'd give it a shot and see what you would do if you could be king for a day. What three big changes would you make to turn the economy around and get us going in the right direction?
Well, number one, I would restructure the private debt that peaked at $42 trillion, way higher than the public debt. That's something you can restructure, like in a Chapter 11 in a business. you know, all these banks and financial institutions lent against way overvalued real estate. Now, that started to collapse. These loans, the government's protecting the banks, not forcing them to mark loans down to market, not forcing them to write down loans. This would free up cash flow for the private sector, consumers and businesses. $42 trillion in debt could be cut to $20 trillion to pre-bubble levels, just back to 2000. That would be the biggest thing to free up cash flow, because demographics aren't going to change. Yeah, baby boomers may stay in the workforce a little longer, but you're not going to change the aging of our society and the slowing from that. You can just only restructure debt. Governments are protecting the banks instead of forcing them. I would only give banks assistance to the degree they write down consumer or business loans, and only maybe 25 cents on the dollar. That's the only stimulus program I would have for the banks. Number two, we've got the lowest long-term interest rates since the 1930s, and they're probably going to go lower. That's the time to invest in infrastructures long-term. But, I mean, investing in infrastructures, they're going to pay off the loans at a profit for governments and municipalities. That's another thing you can do to stimulate the economy and take advantage of low long-term rates. So those are the two big things I would do. The third thing, stop this stimulus. The stimulus just perverts the markets, causes bubbles that crash, and they're going to crucify investors, again, across the board. Real estate's going to go lower, stocks, everything. This stimulus encourages speculation, and that's the worst thing you can have right now. So those are the three things I would do. They wouldn't be popular, but they would work.
You know, that's great. I it's interesting because I think a lot of people are just, as you've described, they're just sort of kicking the can down the road. They're unwilling to take bad medicine. You know, they made themselves sick by their lifestyle, and now they're unwilling to take the medicine. And you know, or they're the people that don't have to worry about it. That, you know, and that's, I think that's the scary thing. The people driving the ship don't have any skin in the game.
Well, you know, and Aaron, one of the things that I see, of course, the people I'm working with is save money and invest money, and most of them have really tightened their belts the last few years. I mean, most of the clients I have either paid off their homes, they've paid off their debt, they're trying to be totally debt-free because they see the future not being real pretty. And so they're trying to get into a situation where they have resources to survive no matter what may happen. And we've been telling our clients for, you know, I've been doing this for 40 years. I've been telling my clients for the last 20, don't count on Social Security because,
exactly,
to me, it's social insecurity.
Yeah, you know, I mean, consumers, especially at the everyday level, and businesses are tightening their belts. That's what government should be doing. They should be closing their deficit instead of trying to expand it and all this stimulus, and they're just not doing it. And, you know, I say the same thing. If you don't want a hangover, don't drink a bottle of bourbon. Well, they already drank the bottle of bourbon. Now they're saying, well, we're just going to keep drinking more, taking more of the drug, so we don't come down off the high. That's the most irresponsible policy in history.
Do you think in looking at what Japan's done, you know, and they're on what, QE 12 or 13?
Oh yeah.
Compared,
yeah,
to our QE 3, do you think that's just a we're kind of living in the movie, and Japan's the movie, and we're just watching it right out in front of us with what our future is?
Yeah, I mean, we're just 11 years behind Japan in the peak of our baby boom, and then Europe's a few years after us. We're all going to go off this cliff. I mean, we're already going off of it, and yet everybody's just doing endless QE to prevent the downturn and hoping it comes with the next administration. I mean, Greenspan got out before the bubble totally burst, and then Bernanke inherited. He's getting out before it burst after putting it off, and Janet Yellen and Obama are going to be the ones probably holding the cards when you have to fold a hand and admit, no, this was a bad hand.
Well, I've heard a couple of guys on Fox Business and on CNBC say that they would not be a bit surprised to see Yellen go to 100 million, maybe to 125, if the markets didn't, if the markets took a big dip like you're thinking may happen. They've said that she may increase easing, and it drives me crazy to call this easing. She's going to print more money, up to maybe $125 billion a month.
Yeah, you know, I think they're not going to end up tapering because they'll wait until after the debt ceiling debate in January and February, because you don't want to do it knowing that could disrupt things. Then they'll wait until Yellen comes in February, at least a month or two, and by then I think the economy is probably going to be weakening in the second or third quarter of next year, and they'll probably never taper, and they may increase. But the point is, I mean, Europe did this in 2012. They had their biggest stimulus plan in early 2012, and they went into a recession anyway, and they still haven't really come out of it because the economy just got weaker and bank loans keep going bad, and real estate keeps dropping, especially in Spain where they had the biggest bubble. So at some point, the stimulus just doesn't work and the system melts down. It's hard to calculate when that's going to happen, but again, from this conference and everything I see and some of our other speakers, it looks like it's going to start melting down in the first half of next year to me.
Well, we've hit the all-time highs, and you've been saying for some time, you've been telling us for some time that once we break through the highs again, kind of like we did in 07, once we break through the highs again, then all bets can be off because something's going to happen.
Yeah, and again, I mean, bubbles end from their own extremes. Our real estate bubble didn't start cracking in 2006 because the economy slowed down. The economy didn't slow down until 2 years later in early 2008. Real estate prices started going down because they got too high. They are to unbelievable extremes in China now, in many cities around the world, like London and Sydney, Australia, and Vancouver, Canada. And at some point, the bubbles just start bursting, and stocks have gotten way too high. I think my best guess is that stocks are going to peak a little under 17,000 in the Dow, about 5% higher than here, early next year. And then they're just going to go down because even the smart money says, okay, this bubble's gone too far. Once the stock market starts going down, once real estate starts going down again, especially if the bubble burst in China, which is the greatest in the world ever, 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 you're not going to be able to stop this. So, you know, at some point, the stimulus doesn't work because stimulus is just borrowing from the future. You keep interest rates low. You give all these incentives for people to buy more, borrow more, expand more, but they're already in debt after the greatest debt bubble in history. And at some point, it just doesn't work.
Well, I'm going to ask you a philosophical question. I don't know if you could answer this because it's been really frustrating to me as a regular person out here trying to live in this economy. What I don't understand is why the news people are so pro government on this spending money, printing money we don't have, and they support the government doing that like it's the greatest thing since sliced bread.
Well, you know, I was on a debate with Ron Insana on CNBC. He called it new enlightened policies, you know, Fed policies, this whole endless stimulus thing. I'm like, you mean just denying a whole debt crisis is enlightened? Printing money out of thin air to cover over a downturn is enlightened? But you got to realize that everybody kind of intuitively understands. I mean, everybody benefited from this bubble. The everyday person less so, but the top 20%, the banks and financial institutions, businesses benefited unbelievably from this bubble. And nobody wants it to end. So the easiest thing to do is just, it's easy to go on TV with all these people, and Warren Buffett's doing it as well. A very smart, one of the greatest investors in history is going on TV after he gets all these preferential deals from the government that he couldn't lose money on if the companies went under. And he's saying, oh, it's okay. We're doing the right things, and American economy is going to turn around. I'm investing. You should invest too. This is what people want to hear. Because nobody can afford. I mean, when bubbles burst, and again, I've studied this more than anybody in history that I know. I've studied every bubble and everything, commodities, real estate, stocks, tulips, you name it. And every bubble burst. And when it burst, it's the worst downturns come when you see deflation from debt deleveraging after bubble because money just disappears. I mean, somebody had stocks that were, you know, worth, you know, $50,000 one day, and then a year or two later, they're worth $20,000. You lost $30,000 like that. All this debt deleverages and fails. This money just disappears. So it's the most violent thing, and the only way to deal with it is to be in cash or to be in the U.S. dollar, which only appreciates versus other currencies in a crisis like 2008, or to be short things like stocks to hedge your portfolio because otherwise, money disappears overnight, and again, people get slaughtered, and people, we're showing now the everyday investors piling, but they were very cautious at first in this rally, but they're piling back into stocks, just getting ready to get slaughtered again. I mean, the government has made it impossible not to be in stocks, because if you're in a bond, you get -2% adjusted for inflation. You get zero on a T-bill. You get 2% on average on a 10-year treasury, below inflation rates. I mean, so people are forced at some point to go into riskier assets, and then the bubble burst. And all the government's doing is keeping the bubble going, as I said earlier. And at some point, the bubble's going to burst, and then all these gains are going to evaporate in a matter of a couple of years, maybe even less.
Well, the real sad part about it is we're always playing catch up. I mean, if you'd invested in 1999 in the S&P index, you didn't get back to where you were until April or May of 2013.
Yeah, and adjusted for inflation, not even then.
Not even then.
Really, you're probably about break even now, adjusted for inflation, which is the real way to measure it. And the biggest bubble burst in 2000 to 2002, but the government ever since has been pushing interest rates down, doing quantitative easing increasingly, just to keep the bubble going. That's all they're doing, is keeping the bubble going. They're not creating any long-term investment in the economy. Businesses have $3.7 trillion in cash, and they're not investing in the future. They're just buying back their own stocks to artificially inflate their earnings per share. I mean, and the government's issuing record amounts of debt and then buying their own debt, almost all of it now. This is insanity. Well, and then, I go on CNBC and people say, oh, I'm crazy. I'm like, no, you guys are crazy. You are in la-la bubble land.
Well, what concerns me is, and one of the things, you had a panel on there, and we were asking some questions about it, and one of the things that really concerns me is next year, if we have this decline in the markets, I see the government is going to have to come after and get more revenue. They're going to have to go after maybe capital gains, a lot of people have called, hearing things on the radio and TV about that the government's going to go in and take over your 401k or your IRA or whatever. And we had a really good discussion there at your session about the possibility that at some point in time, the government might decide that, kind of like they did with Social Security funds, that it's their money, not yours. They might just decide that Roth IRAs should be taxed.
Well, you know, Cyprus was the perfect example. They just suddenly said, we're so much in trouble. Now, this is only after things started to melt down, that we're just going to take 10% of all bank accounts, and we're going to take higher from the richer people. I mean, at some point, the government is going to have to do something, because they're not going to be able to borrow money if they get in another crisis. And this already happened in Southern Europe back in 2010 and 11, where bond rates went so high that several countries just couldn't borrow anymore. And if it weren't for ECB and IMF bailouts, they would have just faced a brick wall. So that happens at some point. That's not going to happen, I don't think, until things start to melt down. But we tell people, protect yourself from taxes, because they have to go up, and especially on more affluent people. They just have to go up. There's no way around it.
I don't see any way. Well, Harry, listen, we really appreciate your time. Thank you very much for spending this half hour with us this Saturday, and hope you have a great weekend, and I'm looking forward to your next summit.
Yeah, and again, people just go to harrydent.com and get our free newsletter. It is a good newsletter, as you know, and it's free because we just want people to get to know us. That's simple.
And it's got great information, and in fact, I saw on one here recently that people that didn't attend the summit can actually buy the tapes of it.
Yes, and like you say, there were some great presentations from Rodney and I, many speakers. We had a guy come all the way from Australia who's an expert on real estate and commodity cycles, but Lacey Hunt, man, you got to hear that one.
Lacey Hunt,
people just love this guy.
Yeah, he is outstanding.
Knows about him. We bring people nobody knows about, because we bring people who talk in the truth, and those people don't get on CNBC most of the time.
Yeah, that guy. I could see him running for political office, because
vote for him in a second.
He
never have a shot at it, though. He's too honest.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, he is
too smart,
and he just reeks with honesty and sincerity.
Yeah.
Absolutely. Well, thank you very much, Harry. We appreciate your time. Really
okay,
do.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you very much. Well, listen, you're listening to Investing Simplified. Hopefully that will inspire you to give us a call at 503-417-7626. That's 503-417-7626. We'll be right back with Investing Simplified.
The time to stop working is approaching, or maybe it's already arrived. CDs and money markets are paying only fractions of a point. How secure do you feel about retiring right now? Call Chuck Price. He's located right here in Portland, and he can show you how to increase your Social Security up to 67% using specific program rules and the file and suspend strategy. Chuck specializes in working with people who are either retired or are close to retiring, and he focuses on how to never run out of money during retirement. Do this today. Schedule a free 20-minute retirement plan phone consultation or schedule an appointment with Chuck himself. Call 503-253-3000. That's 503-253-3000. Chuck Price at Price Financial Group Wealth Management. On the web at pfgwm.com. Got a legal question? Coming up is Carl Jepsen, estate planning attorney and partner of the Warren Allen Law Firm, with Carl's comments. You can call Carl at 503-417-7626. That's 503-417-7626. Here's Carl Jepsen.
Well, welcome back to Investing Simplified. This is Carl Jepsen. It's time for Carl's comments. And after Harry Dent, I'm going to be a little more bland, I think, in terms of what we're going to talk about. We're going to get back to some real basics today. And this is an interactive show. So if you'd like to ask a question about estate planning or investing or the state of the economy or even a tax question, we'll give it a shot today, although our tax expert is gone. Kevin Steggy's out of the studio this weekend. But
Viva Las Vegas.
There you go. Viva Las Vegas. He'll be back. Anyway, we are going to talk. One of the things I like to do is when I talk to my clients is to compare various kinds of tools that estate planners use. And so since Chuck and I do estate planning seminars quite frequently, this is going to be partly a test for Chuck. So I know he'll answer all of these questions correctly. But what I've done is I've created a table, and this is just the fundamental differences between living trusts and wills. But before we do that, I think we have a caller on the line.
We've got Dave on the line here. Dave, you got a question for Carl?
Yes.
Good morning, Dave.
Good morning. Hey, I had a question about I just had my will made out, and then I went to a financial planner. And they said that in my will, there can be a provision added, something about a bypass trust. I just wondered if you knew anything about that.
I do. Here's what, in the simplest form, well, let me tell you first of all, I'll give you some terms that will help you understand that term. That's an estate planning or an estate tax savings tool, I guess you might say. And what you have is every individual under Oregon law has $1 million that they can transfer tax-free.
Right.
So if you live in Washington, you got $2 million you can transfer tax-free.
Right.
Under federal law, you got $5.25 million you can transfer tax-free.
Mm-hmm.
So what you do generally with a husband and wife is if their estate exceeds the $2 million or $4 million or whatever it is, you create a device that allows the first spouse to die to use his $1 million or $2 million or whatever it is, and then when the second spouse dies, he or she also gets to use hers, so that you get basically twice as much bang for your buck. And the way that's done is with the bypass trust. The $1 million, let's say, goes into what we call a bypass trust. Sometimes it's called a B trust. Sometimes it's called a credit shelter trust. Sometimes they call it some other things, but it's all the same thing. What that does is it goes into this trust, and usually what happens is it pays all of the income of that trust to the surviving spouse and allows the surviving spouse to have some
rights to obtain that money for her health or his health, education, maintenance, and support during his or her lifetime. And then at his or her death, when the survivor dies, those assets in that trust have already been taxed, so it never gets inheritance taxed again, and it goes to the heirs, the children usually, tax-free, or inheritance tax-free. There are some limitations on it. It is an irrevocable trust, so you can't really change it after you fund it. You know, once the money's in there, that's it. It has the advantage of essentially tax-free appreciation as well, because to the extent that the assets in the trust appreciate in value, not income, but appreciate in value, those also, since they are already taxed for inheritance tax purposes, don't get taxed when the survivor dies. So, you know, there are some real advantages in doing that. It's something that has to be set up ahead of time. It can be put into your will, and then when you die, your spouse basically has some things to do to make sure that gets funded. There are a lot of different ways of funding that kind of a trust, but it's one of those tools that we use for that purpose. So does that answer your question? It's kind of an estate tax savings.
Is it simpler than somebody was telling me? I've got to get a trust like right now between the wife and I, and we put our assets in this trust. But then, if we don't want to do that now, we can do this bypass trust provision in our current will, and then it happens. You know, like say when I die. I mean,
that's true. And you don't have to create the bypass trust right now in a living trust, say for example,
right?
Or in the will. It's set up so that the bypass trust comes into effect after the first person dies.
Oh, okay.
Either way, so you can do it in the will. One drawback to that, in fact, you should listen, because one of the things we're going to talk about on my Carl's comments is a comparison of living trusts and wills. So this will help you after we get done with that. But the living trust might make it somewhat easier to fund the bypass trust, depending on how you do it. And the other thing is, generally speaking, because of the way we usually fund those things, and usually most husbands and wives own their assets jointly anyway, it probably means that you're going to have to do a probate at the death of the first spouse to get this bypass trust funded if this is only in your will. Because usually what happens is you have to disclaim it. Well, if you disclaim it, then it has to go somewhere, and it has to go, you know. So whereas, and if you can disclaim jointly owned property, but it's got to go somewhere. And in order to get the title transferred, I think you've got to go through a probate. So that's where the living trust makes that part of it a little easier. So now the other thing is you could do the bypass trust in a will, and then later on, if you get older or whatever, you can go to a trust then. You know, nobody ever knows what's going to happen. This last year has been a phenomenal year for me to see many, many people. I've never seen so many people who one day were just fine, and the next day they find out they have some terminal illness, and and they're not always old people.
Right.
And so I've come to believe that it's good to do your planning now, and depending on the nature of your state, a living trust may very well be a useful tool for you in this regard.
Yeah.
But in fact, what I'm going to do is, if you'll hang on while you listen, I'm going to go through the Carl's comments on that.
Your recommendation probably would be just to do it now and get it done with, basically, it sounds like, huh?
Well, it's always on an individual basis. I always look at the individual, estate and things like that. If your estate exceeds the taxable amount, though, it's something you want to think about. I think that you should have, at least at a bare minimum, you should have the bypass trust in your will established at a bare minimum. It may be that once you start thinking about that, it may, and depending on the nature of your estate and assets and things like that, you may wish to establish a trust. And like I said, the elements of the trust are we're going to talk about those here in just a little bit.
So. Well, I appreciate it.
Okay.
Great call, Dave. Thank you.
Thank you.
Great question.
Well, that was a nice segue. It was just perfect.
Absolutely.
For what I was going to talk about. So I've got some attributes of living trusts and wills, and these are yes or no questions. And we're comparing living trusts and wills. So number one, directs distribution of assets upon death. Living trust?
Probate-free. Is that what you're asking?
Yeah. No, I mean, does it distribute? Does it direct the distribution of your assets?
Oh, the trust?
Yeah.
No, actually, that's done by the will. Oh, but the trust may say who they go to.
Right. That's what I meant.
Yeah.
That's what I meant.
Okay. Yeah.
And
okay.
So does the will direct who gets your stuff?
Both
do.
Sure.
So
yes.
That's how
absolutely.
They're similar.
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah.
So becomes effective during your lifetime. Living trust?
Actually, yes.
How about the will?
No, at death.
Okay. There you go. Provides lifetime management if you become incapacitated.
That would be the trust.
Yep. Yeah. And the will?
Nope.
Nope. Okay. May incorporate tax-saving strategies. Yes?
The trust could, but the will probably not.
Well, the will can too, but it, like you said, it's a little bit more
Yeah, only if it had a provision for a bypass trust.
Yeah, exactly. So,
yeah.
Okay. Requires assets to be transferred during life.
That would be the trust.
And does the will?
Nope.
Okay. Revocable during life. Yes?
Yeah. Well, actually, both of them are.
There you go. Yep. You're batting 100%. It's amendable during life.
Both of them.
Okay, there you go. Amendable after death. Living trust, yes.
Well,
will, no.
Okay, the will certainly is it, because that's it at death.
Yep.
The living trust, usually part of that trust becomes an irrevocable trust, which, of course, once it's an irrevocable trust, you can never change it. But on the other part, the living trust that the survivor has, they can always change that if they want to.
See, there you go. You it's a.
So I listen.
There's a bit of a trick question, but you're absolutely
right. When we're doing those seminars, I do listen.
You actually, there you go. Okay, avoids probate. Yes or no?
Not the will, but the trust does.
Okay, how about this one? If you own real property in more than one state, does the living trust avoid the probate in all of those states?
Does it avoid probate in all those states? I'm going to say yes.
Okay. How about the will?
No.
So in other words, one of the big problems is if you own property in separate states and you are doing it with will planning, you can have more than one probate. And
I think we've been through that before.
We've been through this before, yeah. And it's not fun. So
yep.
And it's not cheap. Okay. Here's one that a lot of people do not think about when it comes to trusts and wills. Maintains privacy of your affairs after death.
Well, not the will, but the trust does.
That's exactly right, because what happens is when you have to go through a probate, it becomes pretty much a public record. And so people can go down and see the will. They'll know who the beneficiaries are. They'll essentially be able to look at the inventory if they want to. I mean, and some people do this for nefarious purposes. Not only do they use the public record to try to sell you stuff, but it's also often used as an identity theft kind of thing, and it also is used for people who try to scam the beneficiaries, and so there isn't any real privacy in that situation, whereas the trust can be administered without court supervision and without it becoming a public record, and so a lot of people feel like that's a good thing for them.
You know, Carl, bringing up that point, one of the things, too, that we caution our clients on, if you're the executor of an estate and your parents passed away or whoever you're in charge of, you want to be aware of there's a lot of people out there that will send you fake bills and fake things to get you to pay money. I know we had a client one time that got a thing from it looked like it was Los Angeles County, and it was a tax bill on some property that she came in and said, "Well, I didn't know my dad owned property in L.A." And I said, "I've known your dad for 30 years. He's never mentioned that. I find it hard to believe that he would own property." And it was a scam. When we checked it out, we found out it was a scam. And they just said for $2,000, you can clear the title to this property that was in your deceased dad's name, and it wasn't even legit.
Yeah, every now and then we get one of those things that looks like actually an official government notice. And it's not. It kind of looks like it, but it really isn't. And they're asking for money or something, or they're trying to sell you a service or whatever it is. And you have to look at those very carefully. So that's another reason why it might be a benefit to people for the living trust. And going back to the other one, lifetime management for incapacitation is a really important feature of the living trust because a lot of times, even though people will say, well, isn't a power of attorney good enough? And I guess my answer is really not. And the reason for that is that many times financial institutions and other businesses are so wary of financial elder abuse that they just simply will not honor a power of attorney. We draft the most expansive, broad-powered, detailed power of attorney that we know how to do. But the problem is, every now and then, almost all the time, you know, the child goes to the bank afterwards and says, "I want to, you know, cash the checks and I want to do that. I want to sign the checks." And the bank says, "No," and we can't really do anything about it. It's just very frustrating. They're supposed to, but they won't because they're so worried about, you know, the fact that so many people steal their parents' money or the caregiver steals the parents' money.
Well, you know, Carl, I did some seminars this past week on money management and on investing, and one of the things, one lady that came in asked me a question because she knew that, you know, we did the radio show and stuff, and she asked me about her. She said, "Do you think I should update my trust and my wills?" And I said, "Well, how long has it been?" And she said, "Since 1993.
Whoa, yeah.
And I said, "Well, for one thing, your durable power of attorney and your health care directive might not be sufficient now to under the new health care laws and stuff.
Yeah.
Might not be any good. So I would really recommend that you get together with an attorney. Plus, you mean nothing's changed in your life in the last 20 years?
Right.
You know, so I'm hoping she's going to come see you because her lawyer's passed away, so she doesn't have a lawyer. And I said, "Well, I know one,
you know,
but you need to go see an attorney."
You know, that's
for sure.
One of the myths. I have a number of trusts that come in every now and then. Are, you know, I've had wills that were done in like 1955. You know, and you're going, "Wait a minute," but they look at them and they go, "Ooh, well, we don't." That person's dead now, been dead for 20 years. I mean, and so it's very common. So a lot of times people forget about this, and they have documents that name certain beneficiaries who are now deceased or who now they certainly don't want to give them any money. They have people named in a will that are named as trustees or as personal representatives, and that person's either deceased or they no longer trust them to do that kind of work for them. So it's very important, I think, to when you have those kind of lifetime changes, to look at them. And then the laws changed somewhat. A lot, especially things that were before 2001, a lot changed in the tax laws since that time. So they seem to be a little more stable now. But anyway, so another couple things that come up as far as living trusts are concerned, and that is a lot of people ask about what's the cost. And the cost has to do with not only, you know, the drafting, but there are things that have to be done. The transfer of assets. You do have to transfer your assets into the trust. Not necessarily all of them. Some retirement assets you don't, but you do need to transfer most of your assets into the trust, and that takes some effort. So, you know, a lot of people think, "Oh, well, they don't want to have to go through this hassle." Well, if you want the thing to work, you have to do that. And we try to help as much as we can, but as a practical matter, you know, banks and financial institutions and things like that, they're going to require you to do something to assist them in getting those titles transferred. But if you don't, then you kind of defeated some of the purpose of the trust because then you have to do the probate anyway. So the whole point of that is to make sure that you get those assets transferred. And the cost of it is substantially more than if you just do will planning. There's no question about that. But then again, it saves you a significant amount on the back end for your heirs. You know, the probate can be very expensive, or it's always expensive, but it could be very expensive depending on what your estate consists of and depending on, you know, where it is and the things that need to be done, the state of your affairs when you die. The living trust, almost, you know, and that's the other thing. There are things to do when somebody dies. There is an administration of the trust, but it's not public. It's not there aren't the deadlines, and it's usually simpler and easier to do, and a lot quieter, I guess I might say, and substantially less expensive. It's not like that's not going to cost you something, because anytime you're going to transfer titles and things, it's going to cost something. And you may have to have some advice. You'll have to have some tax advice, undoubtedly, so that you can finish up tax returns and things. But besides that, it doesn't have anywhere near the toots and whistles that you got to do for the court. So
you know, Carl, you bring up a really important part in talking about this today, because one of the things I, You know, you always hear the story about the guy who passes away never says, gee, I wish I had more time to spend at the office.
Yeah.
But in the same respect of that vein, you never have a family who says, oh, man, I'm really disappointed my mom and dad had everything planned.
That's true.
Because I'll tell you what, it is so much easier when you take care of this stuff while you can.
It is. It is. It's really, and the living trust is only one piece of it, but it is a big piece. And you and I have worked with people who, you know, had fairly substantial estates, and we have been able to, you know, work through those in relatively short time, whereas the probate is going to take you at least 6 months. And it's just, you know, now, if it falls apart, if you have heirs or beneficiaries who are, you know, fighting with each other, well, then it's going to fall apart whether you have a will or whether you have a trust.
Yeah.
You know, that's
yeah.
That's just the way it is. And
yeah,
and
there's no foolproof way.
No,
yeah.
No. So, but I think it works out pretty well for most people. And it's not just for the taxable estate. In fact, I think that a lot of times the non-taxable estate gets more benefit in kind of proportionally because they have less money to spend, and so it's less expensive for them to go through the administration process than if they had to have a probate.
Yeah, Carl, if somebody wants to get a hold of you, how do they get a hold of you?
They would call me at 503-255-8795 or at warrenallen.com.
Okay, and you can get a hold of me at 503-253-3000 or 877-50-PRICE, and I'm conveniently located at 555 Southeast 99th Avenue, Suite 103 in Portland, Oregon. And I do want to say this. Carl and I will be having some estate planning seminars coming up in 2014, depending on any changes we may have to make with legislation that may take place. But certainly if you do want to come to an estate planning seminar, we'll be having them, and you can go on my website and register there, and we will contact you and let you know when we have our schedule set up in the various locations we'll be having them at. And usually we have one maybe in Southeast and one in Northeast. And so if you want to sign up for those, we've had I had some money management seminars this past week, and we did four of them, and we had good attendance. And I think everybody got a lot out of it. And I can say this about estate planning. It's something that if you do it and you get it done, it's pretty easy to keep it up.
That's true.
And even if you come back once every 3 years or so, kind of update it. But it's well worth getting it done ahead of time. Listen, you're listening to Investing Simplified. We'll be back next Saturday morning. So mark your calendars and give us a call when we're on the air. Remember, there's no foolish question when it comes to your money. And thank you for listening to Investing Simplified.